Welcome to Redesigning Yourself Beyond Betrayal with me, Lorna Nickel. This is the space for women healing from betrayal trauma to imagine a new vision for their lives. You don't have to let betrayal define you. I didn't. Instead, let's work to reframe it as an opportunity and use design thinking to plant the seeds for post-traumatic growth. Through stories, expert insights, and real talk about betrayal's complex layers, you'll learn to tap into your imagination, set goals, and take steps toward rediscovering the vibrant, resilient woman inside you. I don't know if you're aware, but some of the most fantastic things in life start with a creative mess. So put on your apron. It's time to get creative messy. Welcome all to this episode of Redesigning Yourself Beyond Betrayal, which I'm calling NOLO 2.0, Reflections on a Coupleship. For this episode, I've asked my husband Noah to join me on the podcast so you can learn more about me and about him and us together, since you, the listener, and I are still getting to know each other. Both Noah and I know how hard it is to find videos or podcasts where both the betrayer and the betrayed partner are present, being vulnerable and telling their story. And I think it is so important for folks trying to recover to see examples of this, of other couples that are making progress in their healing. Earlier in our journey, we were so excited to find just one podcast that had two couples on that were talking about their story. It made a huge difference for us. For me, it was validating to hear another woman talk about the anger and the pain she felt, and to learn the steps she took using boundaries to protect herself while trying to stay in the marriage. It was also incredibly helpful to hear all of the strategies they used as a couple and individually. I think it's a challenge to find couples covering this topic because there's a lot of shame involved in being either the betrayer, especially if there's sex and porn addiction involved, and also the betrayed. Neither partner wants to be seen as a pariah in their families or community. But sex addiction and the fallout from it has become so pervasive these days that I think it's really important to talk about it, to air that dirty laundry, to get it out into the open so it doesn't go unchecked and fester. I probably don't have to tell you this, but the patriarchal system that we live in is to blame for perpetuating toxic masculine values and misogynistic behaviors that kind of got us here in the first place. Unfortunately, abusive women is the norm because of this environment. So I feel it's important to try and rip the men that we can out of this deep pit of ugliness and lies and unfeeling so they can be free again, or maybe free for the first time. And that's what I think about sometimes. When I think about Noah, that he has been ripped from the clutches of what Gail Dines calls porn land. And now he's actually free to tap into the vast range of feelings that he has and become a whole person, a person whose insides can now match his outsides. He's become freed to be a creative, passionate person who has healthy values and ways of treating himself and others in the world. And now I want you to meet the love of my life and hear where we are right now in hopes that it will inspire you on your betrayal healing journey. Welcome to the podcast, Noah.
Thank you.
I know that you're a little bit nervous.
Yeah.
And I am too. So we can jump in and be nervous together because this is our first time doing a podcast together.
Okay. Sounds good.
So I'm going to start the questions. I'm just going to pretend like this is a regular podcast episode.
Okay.
Where are we now and how did we get here?
Well, hopefully our stories match up. Physically, we're in Tucson, Arizona.
Yes.
We were in Portland before that. We are living a life where we are both trying to trust each other. And I think from my side, succeeding most of the time, we are trying to make a future together. Mm-hmm. After the betrayal and after going through a lot of recovery together. How did we get here? Well, I admitted to you that I was watching porn 2.5 years ago. Since then, there has been a lot. Do you want me to go through everything that we've been through?
No, you don't have to go through everything. Maybe just the major points. I know. So Noah and I actually started working on a timeline recently, which I brought up with my therapist.
as something that I thought could be healing for me, because I just was kind of looking, trying to look back at the history of all of the things that we've done since discovery, since D-Day. And a lot of it for me has just been like, it's so traumatizing that my brain forgets parts of the recovery. And honestly, we did so many things in such a short period of time. It's hard for me to kind of connect the dots and be like, wait a second, like I kicked you out and then then I kicked myself out. And when did that happen in the scope of things? So I think that my brain is just trying really hard to make sense of the history, but I have these big gaps, things that I can't remember anymore because of disassociation or whatever it is. I don't even know. So that's been kind of an interesting process for us to start doing. But like, what in thinking about the healing that we've done so far, and also the trauma that we've gone through in this healing process, what do you think are like the main points for you?
Well, I was just thinking about how we kept having to make the timeline bigger and bigger to add in more details. I'll go over main points, but I think one of the things also is that I think for both of us, we really were up for trying anything because this was all completely new.
Right.
And we didn't know what would work and what wouldn't. And we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know whether or not we were going to stay together. That was something that I wanted and was doing everything I could to hang on to it. But how do we get here? I think the things that were important were I took responsibility for what I had done as much as I could at the time. There was a lot of uncovering that had to happen. I joined a 12-step group.
When you say uncovering that had to happen, what do you mean when you say that?
I wasn't completely honest at the beginning. I was as honest as I could be, but I was so used to lying both to you and the world and myself that it took a long time for me to get to a point where I could be completely honest.
Yeah. And that was a process that wasn't like, oh, D-Day happened and now you just told me all of the stuff. You told me you're a sex and porn addict and all of the details, and now we're good to go. We can start on our healing journey. There was a lot more information and a lot more details that you ended up sharing with me later over the course of, I would say, like several months.
Right.
That was one of the integrity abuses that would pretty regularly pop up for us.
Yeah. And there were times where I didn't know the difference between the truth and a lie.
Yeah.
Which is kind of scary.
Yeah, for both of us.
So yeah, getting into a 12-step group was important. Learning, there was a lot of learning. So I talked to people in the meetings that I went to and got as much information as I could, starting listening to podcasts, buying books, talking to my therapist, and there was a lot to learn. Getting a therapist who was trained in sex addiction, so getting an actual certified sex addiction therapist, I think was important because I had a therapist who said that she understood sex addiction, but she was not, she kind of had her own way and it was not helpful.
Yeah. And I know what that's like.
Yeah. Working with a CSAT was important because they have a specific methodology they use to help couples work through starting recovery. And that includes doing a formal therapeutic disclosure where I basically told you, you wanted to know everything up from college up to D-Day or up to the present. So you got to decide that. And so basically going into detail about every piece of that and then presenting that disclosure to you in person while we did it over Zoom, because our therapists only met over Zoom. They wouldn't meet in person. So going through that process, the process of therapeutic disclosure is you give the disclosure. Oftentimes there's a polygraph involved to make sure that you're telling the truth to the best of your ability. And then after that is done, you wrote an impact letter, which you delivered to me, or you read to me. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult to listen to. It was hard to hear because I didn't want to admit how much I had hurt you, I think. you know, it's hard to recognize that. But then after that, I wrote a restitution letter based on what you had said in your impact letter. So, and that was, I know that some people do that all like in like a weekend at a intensive, but I actually don't think that would have been healthy for us.
And some people take over a year.
Yeah, some people too. So we did it over the course of like, I think we did the disclosure in August. We did the impact letter in probably November and the restitution letter in December or something like that.
I also had follow-up questions.
Yes, you had follow-up questions. Yeah. There were, I think you originally had something like 60 questions and then you had like 70 more after that, something like that.
Yeah.
So we spent a day going through those questions. One of your conditions after hearing the disclosure was that I go to residential treatment for at least 30 days. Mm-hmm. I think I ended up going for 28 days because that was the program.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I would have been able to. So that day, was it 1 day or 2 days that we went over those questions? I feel like we got them all, the second set of questions through, got through them all in one day.
I think we did. Yeah. I feel like we did it in person. Didn't we do that in person?
Yeah, we did that in person. So I don't think, I guess what I was going to say is like, I don't, so we did that shortly after I came back from treatment. I don't think I would have been able to go through that. I don't think I would have made it through that day if I hadn't gone to treatment because treatment allowed me to see what I had done and face it without hiding. It allowed me to manage my emotions, which prior to that, I was not even aware of a lot of my emotions.
Right.
And it allowed me to sit with you and feel your pain. And because that was a really painful day.
Yeah. Really, when you came back from the inpatient treatment, you had so many tools to work with. And I just remember like a couple of the things. One of the major things was the ice holding, because you would disassociate whenever I would confront you with something that you were, that scared you, that you didn't want to have to talk about because you didn't know, you didn't want to hurt me. That's what you would tell me. I don't want to hurt you. I didn't want to hurt you. So I just didn't tell you or I lied to you. But you would hold these ice packs when we would have conversations that would bring you into your frontal cortex, that would make you have to be present in the moment and not retreat into your shame, into your toxic shame.
Right.
And that was huge. That was so huge for us being able to have these real conversations about what was going on in your mind and, you know, all lots of different parts from history that I would bring up that you wouldn't normally, you would just shy away from and be like, I'm going to talk about that or whatever. I don't think you'd say that, but you just would totally shut down.
I would just avoid it.
You'd avoid it. And then I would totally be able to tell that the something was going on with your face and your body language and stuff, but you wouldn't be able to talk about it. So that was really helpful. And then just, I think learning the about the toxic shame that you had and the living in the shame was not a healthy place to be because it's very selfish there. When you're living in your toxic shame, it's all about me, and I hurt, and I'm so sad, and I'm such a bad person, and all this stuff. And you're not looking out into the world at what you've done and seeing me, and also seeing the ripple out effect. So learning that it wasn't just me, and I think I talk about this in my letter to you, like it wasn't just me, it's our son. And family and friends and the people you work with and all of that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you came back a different person. Like there's something in you. I was told this before you went away, like what, you know, I was like, what should I be looking for? And people would say, you'll know it when you see it. There's a shift. And that's exactly what happened when you came back. I was like, oh, this is a man who's really working on himself and is like 100% plus doing everything he can to be an authentic human being and a trustworthy person and be in this marriage. Whereas before, you were not in this marriage. You were not my partner. You were telling me you were my partner, but you weren't showing up.
Right. I didn't know how.
Why do you think that we're still together?
Well, I have two answers.
Okay.
The first one is I have no idea. The second one is it's complicated. I was thinking about this earlier. I feel like in order for couples in our situation to stay together, they both have to really want to stay together. So first of all, and then that requires a lot of work,
right,
on both sides. I am the one who screwed up and blew our relationship up, but I can't fix it on my own, unfortunately.
Right.
Because there's emotional work that you have to do as well.
Can I just step in for a second and say that I think that's where a lot of traditional therapy goes wrong. And we've learned that in our process of education is that they talk about how we have to stay in our lanes. You have to be responsible for your recovery. And if I'm going to do something, I do it in my lane. But that's not what staying together looks like. I mean, we do both have to do our separate work. And in that same vein of thought, I know that as the betrayed partner, deciding that you're going to do that work to stay with someone who's a sex addict, you have to really like devote yourself to the education and to learning more about empathy and learning more about yourself and your history of trauma, because all of that comes into play when you've been so hurt, you've been so wounded. Like I told Noah the other day, like, you crushed my heart. Like you totally destroyed my heart. So how do you come out of that? How do you build yourself back up from that? You know, Noah's doing his work and I'm doing my work. And then we also had to do like couples work together. And without doing that work, there's no way in hell that we would be here. There's just no way.
There's something that a CSAT that I got to said. Basically, someone has to lay down their armor and their shield and their sword first, right? And in this sort of situation, it should be the betrayer.
Right.
But eventually, we both have to, because that's how we get closer together. We both have to try to trust and show vulnerability if we're going to keep together.
And that's the tricky part, too, though.
Yeah.
That's the tricky part.
It is.
For the betrayed.
I think it's actually tricky for both sides.
Yeah.
I think it is. It's obviously tricky for the betrayed, but I think I told you after I got out of treatment was that I was told there basically just that I didn't trust anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't trust anyone with the true, real me. And so that included you.
Right.
The one person who I should be trusting the most. But in order to do that trusting, I had to lay down my armor essentially, right? And get vulnerable with you. And I think that probably allowed you to see that maybe I could be trusted, or you could at least try trusting me.
Right. And that's, I think, had a lot to do with you going back to those integrity abuses. I don't remember how he presented it one day, but he was like, here's this list of integrity abuses that, you know, betrayers have to try to not do.
Right. Is that the Minwala secret sexual basement list of integrity abuses?
Yeah. And that was so good. That was just so good, because I feel like it's still like a learning process for you, Noah, to keep your sword down and your shield down, because you built your lifetime out of being defensive and, you know, looking for the weak point in whoever was you were having conversation with. And it was always like judgment and judging yourself and judging others and all this stuff. So, you know, when I thought that we were in a partnership and we were taking care of each other and trying to look out for each other, when disclosure happened, my eyes were opened and I looked back at our relationship and was like, oh my God, there were so many areas in our life where you were like a control freak and I didn't have a voice.
Right.
I didn't have a voice. And, you know, people might be, well, what was wrong with you? You didn't have a voice. And it's one of those things where, like, in a relationship, they say that you start out as separate people, but when you come together as a union, however that is, you know, if you get married or you just decide you're going to be with this one person, you actually grow together and you become a union that way. Like it's physiological. Like when we get together and we're, you know, getting along and we're in a good place, our heart rates actually sync up and we establish attunement and we relax and, you know, our breathing slows and we're just in like this comfort area. But when you're in like a dysfunctional relationship, I don't know, you like start out in a place where you think is going to be good. And then it's like these learned behaviors, I guess, that start happening. Whenever I would offer something up, I knew that your first response was going to be no. Oh, maybe we could go on this vacation or whatever. And so then I just learn a way of dealing with that, with no. No is going to say no. How do I plant the seed? You know, I learned my like workarounds, and then like after D-Day, I was like, fuck those workarounds. You know, like I'm done with the workarounds. I need to listen to myself and my own truth now and value that. And also value my intuition because it was so broken. It was so broken from all of the lies and the gaslighting and all of that stuff.
And those no's for me came from fear. I was living in fear all the time, fear of everything. And I still, you know, sometimes when you bring up something, my first thought is, well, I don't want to do that. And then I'm like, well, why not? What are you scared of? Okay, maybe there's, you know, even if there is something I'm scared of, I can still say yes. And I like how you've talked about how our relationship can be about yes and. To go back to the original question, why do you think we're still together? I think part of it is because you decided that you were willing to try and see the good in me. And that we, like, as we were just talking about, we both had a lot of work to do and we both committed to doing that work, no matter how hard it was, and taking suggestions from people and just, you know, trying them.
Yeah. And it's something that I had to do every once in a while. And sometimes I would actually tell you, would be all of the reasons that I love you.
Yeah.
Sometimes you would say, you know, when you were hurting, we were having like a hard time, you would say, I just don't understand why you're with me. Why would you want to stay with me? And I would say, you know, like, you're a thoughtful person and you're handsome and you're sweet and you're smart and you're creative. And so, I mean, as a betrayed partner, though, it's like, I have to feel safe enough to be able to say those things to somebody who's hurt me so badly. And that's where, you know, my personal healing comes into play. So I can actually shower you with some praise. And I think even every once in a while, I tell you that, you know, I see the work that you're doing. I see the work that you're doing to become a better man. So it's not like, you know, you're just telling me that you're doing these things, or you're like, you know, we talked about in your program that some of the guys are just ticking the boxes. Well, I said I would do this, so here it's done. I'm on this step now. Check it off. There it's done. It's like, I'm with somebody who, yes, you are doing the, you did those steps, but you also were like, why, you know, self-inquisitive, you know, why am I this way? I have this toxic shame. What is that about? Where does that come from? Now you're learning about like the inner child and like constantly educating yourself and trying to pinpoint how you got to where you are. And I think that that's a key element to men's recovery in sex and porn addiction, where you don't get to just think about what you're doing now or the watching the porn or the, you know, your relationship with a woman. Like,
you don't just stop. That's not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough. You have to go, oh, well, where did this start, and try and get to the origins of it. Like, what happened to you as a child? What did that look like? And what are those behaviors that you created that you're still using?
Right.
These unhealthy coping mechanisms that you're still using that don't, they're not good for you anymore. I mean, they might have served a purpose when you were 9, but you don't need them anymore. So what are the top things you are doing daily now for your sobriety?
It's a long list.
I know.
The program I'm in, we do a lot of things each day. The 12-step programs are essentially spiritual programs that are a way to find a higher power and be in close contact with that higher power. And I had no sense of spirituality before going into this. But now I pray every day as soon as I wake up. There's some recovery books that I read every morning. I journal on them. I call guys in my program every day, at least five generally. I go to a meeting every day. They're all online. And then I do this nightly review, which also it comes out of the 12 steps of looking at where I was resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid today. What did I do to serve others? Do I need to apologize to anyone? What am I grateful for? So just sort of reflecting on the day, which is something I had never done before. Like oftentimes I couldn't even really remember what I did during the day. And then I think the other big things that aren't so much, they're more kind of in my headspace is one is accepting life as it is. Also having gratitude. So I can accept life as it is. I think in the past, I wasn't able to accept the past. I wasn't able to really accept things that had happened. I'd replay them in my head and try and figure out ways that they could have happened differently. Mm. But I have to recognize that the past is the past and I can't change it. So if I can accept it, I will be a happier person. Another aspect of this, accepting others as they are. I used to be very controlling and tried to make things go the way I thought they should go. And I have to accept that the only person I can control is myself.
Right.
And really didn't even try to be controlling other people. And so if I can just accept them, again, life will be better. And then the other one is working not to judge others. So I've got a lot of self-judgment and I've done a lot of judging of others. I think that leads to resentment and also sort of closes me off from others. It creates that armor and the shield. So I think working just to accept others as they are is something that I'm doing daily as well.
Mm-hmm. I know it's common for sex addicts to have co-occurring conditions. For example, an addict could simultaneously be struggling with depression, anxiety, narcissism, or even something like borderline personality disorder. Would you like to share what your co-occurring conditions are and tell us what your experience has been like dealing with them?
I mean, a lot of things that I deal with, I already actually knew before I even knew I was an addict, depression and anxiety. I have also found out that I have OCD.
And that was most recently.
That was very recently, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was because you thought I might have it.
Yeah.
You encouraged me to look into it.
And I had been reading some information about how OCD can affect addicts with their intrusive thoughts. I wanted you to look into that and see if intrusive thoughts could be minimized by trying to figure out a way to manage OCD, if that was indeed what you had. And then you were tested for it.
Yeah.
And so where are you at now with your co-occurring conditions? So you're taking for depression.
So the thing I realized is they're really all intertwined with each other. I was talking to my CSAT about OCD. We were talking about how, but addiction is also obsessive and compulsive. And so it would make sense that there's this crossover.
Right.
Anxiety has been managed by going through my 12-step program. It has helped me recognize that I don't have to be overcome by fear. I can be afraid of something, but then also recognize that that fear in general doesn't predict the future. It doesn't mean something bad is going to happen. It's something that I can live with and have courage and do the thing anyway. And depression, I am taking antidepressant, but I think also a lot of the depression has come from hiding who I was in the world and pushing down my emotions. So I think that a lot of it has been relieved by recovery as well. The narcissism. So I guess I haven't been diagnosed as a narcissist, but I have been very self-oriented and selfish in the past. And again, the program that I'm in helps to expose to us how selfish we have been and is really focused on serving others.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that, even in the book, Why Does He Do That? By Lendi Bancroft. The author talks about narcissism and how sometimes it can show up in what he calls abusers. And I know that's the term that a lot of men have difficulty hearing, but that even if you aren't clinically diagnosed as a narcissist, you can still have a lot of narcissistic tendencies that are wrapped up in your addiction that you use to partly protect yourself.
Yeah. I think also, you know, like the addiction itself is wrapped up in just selfishness.
Right.
There's self-pity there about like how I was treated as a child. And it's all about getting self-comfort. It's all just about me, right? It's not about what can I do for other people.
Right. And so for the OCD, what are you doing for that?
I've been seeing a therapist who specializes in OCD, and he's been giving me tools to use. Basically, if intrusive thoughts come up, or if I have, you know, fear. So OCD is basically fear-based. It's fear that something's going to happen. And if I do these things compulsively, it will keep this thing from happening. So he's been giving me tools, and we've been practicing ways to recognize that I don't need to worry about what is or isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
I can just live my life. Ideally, the tools will help me do that.
And I know that you've also started a really healthy mindfulness practice too. Like you do a lot of meditation to help calm your nerves and center you. And so I see you doing the things.
I think also with the meditation, a lot of that is about trying to be present. It's also, as I've been becoming more spiritual, it's a way to just listen and relinquish control of my life to my higher power, what my higher power would like me to be doing with my life.
Yeah. So you mentioned to me recently that sometimes you wake up and you just feel like a terrible person, that toxic shame kicks in. What do you do to overcome it? First, can you talk about toxic shame?
Toxic shame is essentially this feeling that I'm a bad person. At my core, I'm just not any good, or I'm not worthy of love, as opposed to just being ashamed of the things that I've done.
Yeah.
They talk about the difference between shame and guilt, and shame is I'm a bad person, whereas guilt is I've done bad things.
Right.
But essentially, I'm just a person.
So sometimes you just wake up and feel shitty.
Yeah, sometimes I just wake up feeling like I'm not worthy. So the things I do about it, I mean, I start my day with readings, recovery readings, spiritual readings, and that sometimes will just help, just doing that reading and then writing down reflections on it. And then I also make calls to the guys in my program every morning. And that is also helpful, because just connecting with people who love me is helpful. Sometimes connecting with you is helpful in that way as well in the mornings.
Is that before or after you make muesli for me? And we eat breakfast together.
That's after. Sometimes making the muesli is helpful just because I'm thinking about you. So, I mean, what it all is like getting out of my head.
Yeah. The head can be a dark place.
And then, you know, I'm coming to realize that a lot of my shame is a habit.
Right.
It's something I've just done for most of my life, felt that way about myself. And so realizing I can change those habits, which is also nice. Another thing I did for a while was I created some boundaries where I recognized that the things I was telling myself were coming from this inner critical voice that I could think of as not really me. And I could make boundaries around recognizing that I wouldn't want other people to be talking to me that way. So I shouldn't be talking to myself that way.
I think that would be a good strategy for anyone to use. And I actually just talked to our son about that recently too. Trying to lay that boundary down for himself.
Because he was being hard on himself?
Yeah. The perfectionist mindset kicks in, and then it's easy to just be down on yourself for not living up to some high, unreachable standard that you've set for yourself. But it's interesting to talk to you about you waking up and feeling shitty in the morning, because I didn't know until recently that you felt that way on a pretty regular basis. And it makes me kind of sad to think about that, because I don't want you waking up feeling terrible in the morning. Nobody should have to feel that way. But then the other day, well, I think it might have been yesterday, I was just super triggered by social media. And it's easy for me to get triggered by all of the horrible things that are happening to women in the world, around the world. And so I was just kind of like on my run. I was thinking about how sometimes I go to bed and wake up angry, just like pissed off at the world. And that's not a very healthy place to be either. And that's something that didn't really happen to me until, you know, till D-Day, that I would have these periods of time where I'm just angry. And I can spend a lot of my time during the day being angry. And it's not a healthy place to be. And so I always have to figure out ways to climb out of that pit. And one of the things that I started doing recently was when I feel super shitty about the world and about being an oppressed class, because that's what women are, I started painting again. And that brings me so much joy. And I know that you have a creative practice too that brings you joy. Do you want to share what that is?
I guess it's called bead stitching. I feel like no one ever knows what I'm talking about when I talk about it, but it's essentially like doing bead work, making bracelets and things like that. I love sharing with people how creativity can really help.
Yes.
When they're feeling that way. With guys that I work with who are addicts, just replacing their bad habits with good habits in like downtime, mm-hmm. so that they have something to go to. So creativity, I feel like it's a big part of that. I think a lot of people haven't really been creative. So it's exciting to see them pick up that sort of stuff.
Yes, creativity can play such an important role in healing. So I am going to segue right now because, Noah, it's the holiday season. It can be a really challenging time for betrayed partners and couples also trying to heal. So do you have any advice for men in recovery during the holidays or for other couples on their healing journey?
I think my advice for men who are betrayers is to recognize that this time can be really hard for your partner and to make sure that you're checking in with them and asking them what they want out of this time. Not making assumptions about what you can do, but finding out what they need and what they want. Because like for you in the past, you didn't want to celebrate certain things.
Yeah.
So recognizing that old traditions are likely gone and your partner may not be ready to make new traditions, or they may. So having conversations about that, even though it's hard and can be painful, I think is important.
Yeah, you're right.
Do you have suggestions?
Yes. So what you folks might not know is that recently Noah and I collaborated on creating coupleship activity cards for reestablishing connection after sexual betrayal. And these cards are not quite available yet. They are actually at the printers as I speak, and they are going to be available probably early 2025. But I just wanted to make a suggestion from one of the activities on the cards, which is to take a nature walk or a hike. This is an activity that's easy to do. It's free, usually, unless you go someplace that costs money. But it's just about getting out into the outdoors and nature. So this could be a park, it could be a botanical garden, it could be just a trail someplace, or just around the neighborhood. This can be really helpful because it builds certain skills like mind-body connection, thoughtfulness, attunement, bonding, and collaboration, even mindfulness. So you and I go out regularly on either a hike or a run. And when I say regular, I mean, like I try to drag him out with me every Saturday to go. I go trail running and sometimes he runs with me or sometimes he takes a different route by himself. But it's just really nice to be out in fresh air and to connect with nature and hear the nature sounds and also connect with your body and hear your breathing when you're huffing and puffing trying to get up the hills or down the hills. And then just being like amazed, I think, at the ability that your body has to carry you through life and through the trail or, you know, wherever it is that you're going. And then at the end of that, if you're together with your significant other, at the end, you can have a conversation about what your favorite part of that was. And sometimes it can be, oh, I just got to spend time with you, or like holding your hand was really nice. Or did you see this particular cliff or tree or something like that? And I know that you and I share photos sometimes afterwards. And I think that's just a really nice way to stay connected with one another, to have these experiences where it's you and I together, and then we're also in this beautiful environment, and then we have something to look back on. And it's just like a relaxing time that I enjoy. How do you feel? You hate it?
No, I love it. and you're not dragging me out there. I was thinking about, you're just talking about being amazed at what your body can do and sharing what our favorite parts of the walk were. I think that's gratitude in action. And that's why I think this activity is good, because it's focusing on that kind of gratitude. And it's a habit that we need practice in order to get good at.
Yeah. But practice doesn't make perfect, because we're not after perfection, right? We're after progress.
Right. Progress is all we need.
So that concludes this episode of Redesign Yourself Beyond Betrayal. I hope that you feel like you've benefited from getting a glimpse into the window of Noah and my recovery journey. Because our conversation ended up being so long, I broke it up into two parts. So stay tuned for part two of NOLO 2.0 Reflections on a Coupleship in the next episode. In the meantime, if you have questions for either of us regarding our recovery journey, please send them to hello@thewomanhouse.com and we'll see if we can get them answered in the next episode. If you're interested in finding out more about the coupleship activity cards, or you would like to pre-order them, go to thewomanhouse.com. Until next time, we wish you a peaceful and joyous holiday season.
Thank you for listening to Redesigning Yourself Beyond Betrayal. If you like this podcast, please consider following it, liking it, and sharing it with your friends. Putting this content out is a passion for me, but it's also a lot of work. So I appreciate all the support I can get. Until next time, love yourself and don't forget to get messy.